Mr. Mohanty, welcome to Conversation With.
Thanks for having me. It's a privilege to be talking to you.
Is Bitcoin a scam?
I will not say it's a scam. I would think in a very different way. So I think the best way to describe is to look at the history of Bitcoin. So I'll take you a 10 years back journey now. So it was October 2008, this anonymous writer called Satoshi Nakamoto wrote this interesting white paper called Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. And the abstract of that white paper, if you read the first line, it says a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash, which can be used to send money from one party to another party over a network without going through a financial institution.
On a scale of 1 to 10 of risk, if we say 10 is something that we know pretty well, like gold, where does cryptocurrency stand?
It's nowhere to any of this rating. I will not go to a rating of where this
is. It's
not even one, because it is at a very experimental stage. We are just trying out different use cases in cryptocurrency. I am buying Ether to write a smart contract. So this whole set of experiment going on, it is too early to even consider this as a financial product. I just want to ensure that people don't lose sight of the original intent of Bitcoin. It was supposed to be an alternate payment system. It is far, far away from the outcome it's supposed to generate. You can't buy a simple coffee using a Bitcoin instantly in the way it is done today. Till you get there, let's not even talk about any comparison with existing financial instrument.
Isn't it rather confusing, Ms. Mohanty, that we're getting different regulations from different regulators, which seem to be a bit conflicting? Japan is doing one thing, South Korea is doing one thing, China is doing one thing. This is very confusing, surely, though, for investors. And cryptocurrency is supposed to be across borders.
Sure. I think the challenge has been the speed at which things are happening. And especially large market like China, it can grow very fast. So the Chinese regulator has to do something dramatic. I'm just going to stop this Bitcoin, ban the Bitcoin. While Japan has taken a different approach, they're not banning Bitcoin, and they're saying, I will regulate the exchanges where the Bitcoin is getting traded. So based on the domestic issues and challenges that they face, they're reacting to this whole Bitcoin craze. So I would say directionally, all the regulators are in the right direction. Eventually, they'll end up in regulating exchanges. They'll work on protecting customer. They'll put prudential measures to ensure this market don't go crazy. But the timing has been different, primarily, as I said, because of the intensity of the respective market of in the whole space of crypto. And that's the reason you see different, there's a lag in action by different regulators.
Do you think that all the regulators ought to come together to actually come up with a common standard?
They are talking, they are discussing. It's a part of every time regulators meet. Cryptocurrency is a big part of the discussion. And they're watching it very closely. I think they're being very thoughtful, and they're ensuring that we understand this better. We understand what is good, what is not good. But I think the larger question out there is how fast we can get there and ensure that it doesn't become a big problem.
What about a timescale, though? When do you think we're going to see a more stable, both from a legislative point of view, that will make things more calm for the market within the next 3 months, one year?
I'll put a year, maybe sometime early next year. Most of the regulators will have at least came with some kind of clarity around exchanges, and that will calm down. But any speculation will hit this bubble, and I hope that we bring some rationality to this whole discussion. But I don't see that regulators will sit and watch this thing going way out of control. So my best guess is a year.
Will Bitcoin, do you think, end up in a Lehman Brothers-like crash? Mr. Mohanty, can you explain blockchain technology as if you were explaining it to your 10-year-old son?
I would not explain blockchain to my 10-year-old unless there's a technical interest of blockchain. I always use this example. Think blockchain like an email. When you send an email to somebody and you copy, let's say, five people, and that information gets copied to five different people, exactly same information, and if they all reply back, if anyone reply back copying everybody, everybody gets a copy of the same information. So you have already created a blockchain, distributed, exactly same information. Any future correspondence get copied to everybody. So you create a trail of chain of information, and everybody has identical information about that whole set of conversation. If one of you choose to just delete all the emails, you still have four copies of identical information at four different places. So think blockchain as a series of communication connected by a chain of event, and they're all copied at every possible node. So there's a transparency. There's no centralized party controlling whether the information is authentic in between one party versus other party.
The central person, in other words, where the first person who sent the email, in the past, the cost has been that we always had to go back to the central person and ask them about the contents of all this whole chain of discussions in the email. But now, when you say with blockchain, we don't have to, because anyone in the discussion group, so to say, has the same information as the originating person sending out the email.
Yes.
And that's what you're saying will be the reduction in cost, because now we don't have to go back to the central party.
Absolutely. And that is the beauty of blockchain, that it is not running on a trust, it is running on a decentralized network where every party has an identical information of the whole chain of exchanges we had, and you don't need to have a central party to be verifying this information every time we exchange among each other.
And that will reduce costs.
Absolutely. And that will reduce costs. It is a far better system in terms of processing, and it can create other opportunity in terms of building new use cases into this whole blockchain process.
Where is Singapore in all of this? Singapore is being called the hotbed for cryptocurrency, you know, applications. Where does the MAS stand about cryptocurrencies?
We have taken a view on the cryptocurrency, on the underlying technology behind cryptocurrency, the whole blockchain piece. We perhaps globally are running one of the largest experiment on blockchain. It's called Project Ubin. It has a series of multi-year experimental outcome, starting from domestic payment, cross-border payments, settling securities using that blockchain platform, using digital currency. I think that's where we are interested in, and we'll continue to put a lot of effort to understand the underlying technology, which has got a real outcome, which has got a meaningful opportunity to think all this alternate way of running infrastructure. And that's where our focus will be. And the ecosystem around us are also reacting to that experiment, and you see Singapore becoming a hotbed of blockchain companies. I'll not necessarily say it's a hotbed of cryptocurrency companies, but definitely we are becoming a leading hub when it comes to blockchain companies.
So will it be cheaper, for example, for me to transfer money to my aunt in Bangkok?
Absolutely. I think that is the killer app behind the blockchain technology, especially cross-border transfer. Today, if you look at a cross-border money transfer, it takes somewhere between 2 to 3 days to get the money on the side, primarily because there's a bit of checks going around the trust and with the verifying the beneficiary, anti-money laundering checking. They have to do a whole set of checking to send and can confirm the transaction on the side. Blockchain will solve that problem. And that's the experiment we are doing. It will be an instant cross-border transfer, far cheaper than what you see today. And that's where there will be a meaningful change in the whole cross-border payment. And we will see that happening, and hopefully as part of Project Ubin, we will prove that experiment a real meaningful way to do cross-border.
Will Bitcoin, do you think, end up in a Lehman Brothers-like crash?
I don't see at this point of time, because I know the market cap is $250 billion. As it stands, it keeps on changing every day. I think regulators will clamp down, and they will not let this to be that. It not be a financial stability issue, if that's the question. Already, you can see many jurisdictions wants to regulate exchanges. And if you understand why they want to regulate, is because they want to ensure there's no money laundering or terrorism financing going when you're exchanging Bitcoin for cash. So that's a great indication of the regulators are getting serious about this whole cryptocurrency market. And if the market grows beyond that size, you will see regulators coming and applying the consumer protection regulation. They'll start getting worried about consumers losing out money, and they will put the necessary regulation around consumer protection. If the market goes beyond that, they see it as a financial stability issue, they'll put macroprudential regulation. And that will naturally correct all the speculation and normalize the whole market. So regulators will come as the market sizes increases, and that will in the long run not lead us to this Lehman crisis like situation.
Are you sure about that though, sir? Because the regulators are very clever, as I'm sure you are as well, but we have known them to fail. That is why we had various crashes previously. All the loans that were being done in the US. So we had a whole lot of defaults on the mortgages. The regulators could have stepped in earlier, they did not. So while I'd love to say that, yes, I agree with you that regulators are sure to be able to catch it in time, you can't guarantee that, can you?
We are in a different time now. And I think, to be fair, I think regulators are far more agile, far more connected. And especially when it involves technology, it's not only regulators. There's a whole set of tech community constantly writing blogs, articles, warning each other. The whole awareness around this whole cryptocurrency is far more greater than the serious issue we had in a decade back. So I don't think we can compare that to the whole financial crisis. Now, the speed at which regulators are reacting will be far more better. That's the reason I repeat again, a lot of regulators are now looking at regulating the exchanges to start with. Even Singapore, the upcoming payment regulation update, which is happening early part of next year, you will see some regulation from Singapore around regulating crypto exchanges. So this is going to happen. And we know exactly when to intervene based on the market size and the demand and the transaction volume, and we will come in the right time. So I'm not overly worried about getting into some large financial system crisis.
Yeah, so no Asian meltdown. Currency crisis,
no,
meltdown
no, no, no,
with
no,
hot
no,
money,
no, no,
okay.
No. But I must say that we must balance it out, caution to the people and putting money behind it. But we should not lose the sight on the experimental value of cryptocurrency and the underlying technology. Regulators must support that piece of experiment. We should not shut down a great idea because some speculator chose to speculate the market in a way which is not appropriate.
Singapore is trying to move towards the cashless society. It's been done in some other countries as well. Why the importance of having Singapore go cashless? And in fact, many countries are doing that.
I think Singapore has a big advantage of, already has a big advantage of being a cashless society. I'll not say completely cashless. There'll be some cash in the system because it's a natural progression of any evolution of financial system. Singapore already has one of the most banked country. 90 to 95% of our citizens and residents have a bank account. We have one of the best financial, the internet infrastructure. We have perhaps the deepest and widest digital banking penetration. People are comfortable with the phone. They're getting addicted to phone. That's a different problem. So we have the right ingredients to do transaction online, electronically, not necessarily using cash. So the infrastructure exists. The current way of paying each other is predominantly electronic. In fact, Singapore has close to, I'll say, one statistics talks about 11,000 odd transaction per inhabitants, which is probably one of the top three countries with the highest number of credit card transactions is Singapore. So we are already a largely electronic cashless society.
What about those who say that a cashless society is also a means by which it can be a surveillance society, that it could easily become a Big Brother surveillance society because it means that every transaction, every payment is recorded?
I would argue the other way around. Being electronic, being on a social network, being on internet is already, that information is already public. If you write an email, if you go to an internet, you're searching on Google, you have far more serious information out there than this whole payment information. So society has taken up the whole digital method of exchange of information, payment, without necessarily overly worrying about privacy.
But Ms. Mahanti, that's terrible. You're saying that, oh, just because you've already, exposed yourself, well, why not keep on exposing yourself?
No, not exposed. There's a natural demand. People are comfortable with the idea of using electronic way of exchanging information, making payments. It's to me, it's a moot point whether it affects your privacy. Of course, privacy is very important. You have to protect the privacy of a citizen. If that is not done, this is a real serious problem. But that's a different question. But by saying that you are paying electronically at somebody affects your privacy is a bit of a stretch. I would rather think your private information, which you have, it has to be protected so that nobody violates your privacy. But if you choose to send money to me...
Well, in the case of, let's say, merchants, you say, and others, let's make it real, if you go in and mm-hmm. pay for your coffee, mm-hmm. if all of this is all gives a pattern of my behavior. So you're saying, therefore, that people are trading convenience for this lack of privacy. But they may not realize it, you see,
absolutely.
Sir. And isn't that something that MAS ought to be noted, alerting them to?
No, I think that's is very, very difficult question for me, because one hand, consumer wants to be remote, anonymous. They want to pay electronically. And same time, we go and tell them, hey, your privacy is getting exposed. I think that's a very difficult situation to be in. I would rather think this other way around. I'll say, look, if you are sending information to each other, if there's a violation of your privacy, we should have enough law to protect you. That's where we should put our mind behind. If there's information which you don't want to share, if you give me information I'm as part of your transaction, and you are saying you cannot share this information to somebody else, and that's an explicit understanding you have, and if I violate that agreement, I should be taken into court. Also in some markets, especially private player capturing information, where they can create what I call almost an exclusion because of digital data I have about you. And if I know everything about you, most likely I may exclude you from my ecosystem.
Precisely.
And that is a real social problem coming out of this whole digital journey. I'm not denying that. And we have to be thoughtful of how to address that issue through better law, better consent architecture, and a better management of consumer data. So that they're real problems. But we cannot answer this by saying, by just putting a caution statement, be careful before you send your electronic payment.
Yeah.
That may not be the right approach. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yes, and also if all the merchants, in other words, if every coffee shop says I can only pay electronically, then effectively, even though my currency is perfectly valid, my Singapore dollar is perfectly valid, I can't even present it to them because they won't accept it. So in a way, that I've already been locked out.
I don't think we'll have that situation in Singapore at least. I don't think shopkeepers will deny for you to accept your cash. I think that's not the point. It will be an alternate path. So you can give them cash if they choose to. If you choose to do electronic transaction, they will accept electronic transaction. I don't think that situation will be there in Singapore.
Well, MAS will make sure that they will still be able to accept that.
Absolutely.
I'll still be able to buy my coffee with the currency.
If you choose to pay by cash, they will have to accept that cash. I think that's not the situation we are looking at. But definitely we're looking at make the process far more efficient, and hopefully we provide at every merchant terminal an alternate way to pay money.
In a cashless society, we will be flashing our cards. And how will we be able to keep check of how much we're actually spending? Will it not make us also a much more consuming society, perhaps a less reflective consuming society?
In fact, there are many apps available to warn you every time you spend. And it says that, hey, this is your income, this is your... money management principle. You want to spend this much money on food, this much money on travel. You just exceeded that. So there are apps available.
So you're not worried about that going cashless means more consumption?
No, there are apps available. So there will be a market force which will create application to address this concern. So this is an ecosystem problem. And you see in US, many apps, many fintechs apps are primarily designed to create a better financial management. And they go to a transaction level. They'll alert you at the point of transaction. So there are technology, there are applications coming to just protect consumers to not get overly exuberant in the whole payment, electronic payment ease. And in that process, they lose they create a lot of expenses way beyond their control.
Final question. Do you own any Bitcoin?
No, not at all. I can't own a Bitcoin. I have a serious difference on the way it is currently matured. So I will wait for a real use case. I'll wait for a real value before I can think of buying a Bitcoin. And again, just to be context this properly, because the regulator, we have to look at the whole maturity cycle of this cryptocurrency. And at an appropriate time, we will bring the right regulation to protect the industry, whether for consumer protection or prudential reasons, so that there's no stability risk to the whole cryptocurrency business. But I, at this point, my answer is no. There's no logical, rational reason to me for buy Bitcoin and get excited about it.
Mr. Mohanty, thank you very much for being on Conversation With.
Thanks for having me.